asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking family first entrepreneurship with Steve Chu.
Yeah, our guest today, he might be considered a serial entrepreneur, right? So fed up with his traditional 9-to-5, Steve launched an e-commerce site after he saw some success with selling on eBay. And then the success of that site led to a blog. And then once that was making some serious money, he created an online course. And then the success of that led to a podcast and a conference. And I think today he's in the process of launching a couple more businesses. I will be honest, this sounds a bit overwhelming to me personally. But what is important to note is that Steve Chu's goal isn't to simply grow, to scale, to maximize the revenue. Instead, he is interested in businesses that allow him to achieve his goals, and in his case, to create businesses that are family first. And even though that is the name of his book, Family First Entrepreneurship, Steve is really just writing about how regular folks can achieve financial freedom without sacrificing what matters the most to them. So we're going to be talking about that today, and we're going to discuss why everyone out there should consider entrepreneurship, how to figure out what kind of business to start, marketing that business, and, you know, the things that hold folks back. We're going to be talking about all that, plus plenty more today. Steve, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
I am happy to be here. You know, what's funny is I don't actually consider myself a serial entrepreneur.
No? Okay.
I basically have two things. I got the online store and I got the content side of the business.
Okay. That's exactly what a serial entrepreneur would say, Steve. They would downplay all their endeavors. So okay. I'm going to think you protest too much, but we'll get into the specifics. The first question, though, that we asked.
I don't have a problem.
Right, exactly.
I can stop anytime I want.
That's just your perception, okay? Okay, man? But the first question we ask everyone who comes on the show, Matt and I, we splurge on craft beer while still saving and investing for the future, trying to be smart on both ends, living life in the here and now while also thinking about tomorrow. What's that for you? What do you splurge on currently that some people might think is a little bit crazy?
The only thing I splurge on really is NBA finals games. And I've just been lucky. Like, the Warriors have just been really good for these past, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. So
I've heard that.
I go to the playoffs, I go to the finals, and I spend a lot of money. Like, my friends are like, what, are you crazy? But, you know, it's fun. It's my only splurge.
You're a man named Stephen Curry, who I hear is very good with the basketball.
That's my brother.
So I know nothing about basketball, but I do see celebrities and the fancy folks sitting courtside. Is that you? Like, are you feeling the sweat? Are they falling into your lap? That kind of thing?
So that's beyond my budget. So those courtside seats are like $30,000.
Whoa.
I usually invest that's around insane. $7,000, which is usually good for like the fourth or fifth row.
Okay. Well, that's still really dang close, though. Fourth or fifth row.
I will say, Matt and I, we splurged on an MLS final game, but it's such an inferior sport that you can get tickets to that for $180, I think is what we paid. So it's just a big difference in quality, and I think that's why it's so much cheaper. Well, Steve, I'm curious about your humble origins. One time I heard you say that when you were referring to your childhood, that you started studying for the SAT in fourth grade. So I feel like that's indicative maybe of just something interesting going on behind the scenes in childhood. Why were you studying for this? Like, most kids don't even study. They just show up and take it. So why are you studying in elementary school?
I mean, it wasn't by choice.
I thought you were just that much of a go-getter.
No. My parents actually made me do that. And the problem I had was my brother, he's pretty much a genius. He took the SATs, I believe, in sixth grade, and I think his first score that he got was like 13-something.
Oh my gosh. Goodness.
And then he eventually got 1550, and yeah, I don't know. My parents just wanted me to study for it because back in the day, it mattered a lot more for college.
Sure.
And here's the real reason why I started so early. It's because they wanted me to qualify for this nerd camp, and... And in order to qualify for that, you had to break 1,000, I believe, in sixth grade.
Okay. All right. Well, I like that there is a more immediate goal than for you to progressively get better and better at the SAT every single year you take it.
Did you end up going to nerd camp? And if so, how was it?
I did. Yeah, I went to nerd camp.
Of course you went to nerd camp.
Come on, guys. Come on. No, it ended up being a great experience because I got to say, like, I was kind of cocky as a kid, like, you know, because of my parents, I was always way ahead of everyone else. But that nerd camp was like the first time where I was like probably the dumbest person at that camp. So,
Steve, let's we're going to be discussing entrepreneurship this entire episode. But just kind of quickly here, like, what is the biggest selling point of entrepreneurship? You know, like, if you were talking to someone who just had a standard normal W-2 job, what would you say to convince them to consider at least starting their own thing?
I mean, really, people start businesses for freedom. You know what's funny? When I was in college, you know, when you're in college, you have the best life. You have no responsibilities. You just have to study, do whatever you want. And I remember when I was about to graduate, I was like, wait, so now I got to go into this office 40 hours a week?
Yeah.
And then I only get weekends off. And I think most people just don't want to be working 40 hours a week. They want to have options. And really, that's the appeal of entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And it's interesting. People have different reasons for different things. I was listening to Walter Isaacson being interviewed. He wrote the new Elon Musk biography. And he's talking about the thing that helps you to succeed in Elon Musk world is not having other priorities in life, basically. Not wanting balance, not wanting freedom, just wanting to put, you know, be an interplanetary species and put people on Mars. And so you're saying, well, the reason there are some people who are that dedicated to their work, but if you want balance, if you want freedom, then entrepreneurship is the route to go.
I mean, there's no such thing as balance. I don't know how far you guys got in my book, but I talk about the four burners theory, which states that your life is basically dictated by four burners. So you got family, you got health, you got business, and friends. Right? And in order to do one thing well, you got to turn off at least one of those burners. In order to do something really well, you turn off two. And if you're like Elon Musk, you turn off all of them except for the work burner.
That's right.
Right? So, I mean, so basically the theory is about priorities. You can't do it all. So you really got to choose what you want to be good at.
Well, as much of a proponent of starting your own business as you are an entrepreneur, you talk about the lies of hustle in your book, right? Like, there's a lot of folks out there and they're like, you got to get after it, you got to grind. And a lot of folks kind of wear it almost as a badge of honor. But that's kind of the opposite approach of how it is that you like to approach entrepreneurship.
You know, the thing is, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. It's because if you look at all the business books out there and maybe all the videos that you see about entrepreneurship, they're all written by single dudes, right? I mean, to be frank, I mean, they can work 60 hours a week, but I got a family. You guys got lots of kids. I actually want to see my wife. I actually want to see my kids. So there had to be a different way. And that's the way basically I run my businesses. And I can't tell you how many people that I've interviewed on my podcast that have gotten divorced over their business. And it's hard, right?
And
I think the problem is, and this happened to me actually too. When you start making money that you're not used to making, you start getting this fever and you just start wanting to make more and more money. And I was setting these ridiculous goals for our business where we'd try to grow like 50%. And then once we hit that goal, I'd move the goalposts again. And pretty soon I was driving my wife crazy. And then one day she came to me and she broke down. She said, hey, why are we doing all this? I mean, we don't even spend a fraction of what we make. Why are we killing ourselves to meet this ridiculous goal that you've been setting? And that's when I came to the revelation and kind of got out of that fever and realized why we started our businesses in the first place, which was to hang out with the kids.
Oh man, isn't that the thing? Like that rudder can get off slightly, and over a few months or a few years, even you're aiming for the wrong thing. And that sounds like a conversation. It sounds like I'm glad you responded that way, because there's a lot of people who would say to make more money, duh. But yeah, when your aim is off, you're going to be moving in the wrong directions. And I want to dive just a little bit deeper on the four burners thing, because you talk about that, and it is so interesting. There's like, how do you suggest people then, if you're like, you see how successful somebody like Elon Musk is, but most people don't realize and don't see the effort, the grind, the lack of like interpersonal relationships that someone has to go through in order to reach those heights. So how have you thought about which burners to turn on and turn off? And are you kind of constantly adjusting those? Like, what does that look like in your life?
I mean, realistically, all the burners are constantly being adjusted. I mean, if you think back to when we first started our first e-commerce store, which was over at Bumblebee Linens, we basically turned off the friend and the health burner to get up and running pretty quick. We weren't hanging out, and then I was eating like crap. I was really out of shape. But hey, you know, we were spending all of our time on the business, and that's why it did so well in that first year, and that's why it eventually became a seven-figure business. Here's the other thing about the burners. They're all not quite independent. Like if your health burner is up, then you got a lot more energy to devote to the other burners.
Yeah,
you talked about that in your book. Can you talk more about how in your mind, like you basically said that the health burner is almost like a foundation in order to succeed.
Like
at
a
all
turbo
the other
booster
ones.
For the others, huh?
Yeah, I didn't discover this until much, much later. In fact, so I went low carb in 2014. I lost about 35, 40 pounds, got a six pack, and all of a sudden, like, I don't get tired anymore. Like, I have energy to go the entire day.
I thought you were
going to
say that's when you started male modeling.
No. Okay, so I don't have the six-pack anymore. It's impossible to maintain that thing, let me tell you. It was just purely a vanity thing that I just wanted to say I had. Took a couple photos, and that was that. But I still, you know, eat correctly, and I make sure I exercise 2 to 3 times a week, and I feel great. Never had food coma or anything like that.
I love it. Yeah. Okay. So let's rewind the clock a little bit too. So you kind of jumped to where you got to a breaking point with you and your wife with the business Bumblebee Linens. But take us back in time a little bit. Take us to when it was that you decided to kind of launch into that. I mean, you basically discussed it was, again, it's sort of your wife having a moment where she said she didn't want to keep her job anymore, and she had a pretty sizable income. Can you talk about that event and how that led you down the path of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so that was back in 2006, I want to say. And, you know, here's the thing. Like, I grew up, my parents are first generation, her parents are first generation. We didn't see our parents much. My parents basically came here with nothing. So I used to play club volleyball. I used to play volleyball for the school. And guess what? My parents were never really there on the sidelines watching me. And my friends' parents were. And I didn't blame them. But I always wished that they were there. And so when my wife told me she was going to quit, I was like, "Hey, I'm fully on board with that decision, because I think we need to be more present in our kids' lives." And where we live in the Silicon Valley, it is expensive. You pretty much need two incomes in order to get a good house and a good school district. And if she was going to quit, she was making six figures at the time, working for a Fortune 500 company. We basically needed another income, and so that's basically how this whole thing got started.
Okay, so you're like, it's basically this, hey, my wife wants to stay home. I got to figure out a way to pull this off. And then how did that translate to starting a linens company? Did you have like a history in that space? Did you have like some proprietary knowledge? Or what was like, oh yeah, this is the small business to start?
So the only history we had was when my wife and I got married in 2003. You got to understand this about my wife. She's a crier. and usually it's tears of joy. Sometimes I make her cry for non-joy reasons. But at our wedding, she knew she was going to cry. We spent all this money on photography. Like, I think the whole wedding industry is just way overpriced. And she didn't want to be seen in the photos drying her tears, you know, with a tissue. She wanted to be classy with a handkerchief. And so we looked all over the place in the U.S., couldn't find any. Finally found this place in China. It was a factory, essentially. And we had to buy a bunch. So we bought a couple hundred, which was the minimum order quantity. And we used maybe a handful of them and then just listed the rest on eBay, and they sold like hotcakes. So when it came time to start that business, you know, in 2006, 2007, we got back in touch with that factory.
Nice. Yeah, so that kicked it all off. And we're going to spend more of the episode talking about how folks can essentially launch their own businesses. But, you know, this is the one that y'all started.
It sounds so serendipitous, by the way, when you say it that way. Like, it just kind of happens.
It boils it down.
Yeah, selling some extras and, oh, wow, what a great business. Yeah.
Well, there's more to that. I mean, that wasn't like our first choice, actually. Our first choice was actually starting a Kumon. Do you guys have Kumons over in Georgia?
Oh, yeah, the learning Center, yeah.
Yeah, because that's right up my alley, right? SATs, fourth grade, yeah. I can train.
It's exactly. Like your own proprietary nerd camp for kids.
Exactly. But it turns out it would have cost us about $350,000 to $400,000 to open one of those. And then we looked at like other things like boba stores and whatnot, and it just required so much capital. Whereas with our store, it really only... We invested $630 to start that thing.
Exactly. Well, and that's one of the things you address in your book. You talk about how truly, like a lot of folks, when they think about entrepreneurs, they think, oh, I've got to bet the farm. I've got to go big or go home. You know, you quit your day job. You go all in on a new idea. But talk to us about how you were able to gradually cut back at your 9-to-5 as you were able to ramp up your online e-commerce site, because that was one of the ways that you were able to mitigate that some of that risk.
I mean, to be honest with you, it's even easier today. You don't need a lot of money to start any business today, thanks to the internet, right? And thanks to AI now, actually, even more. That's like the next generation. So we started everything, like back in the beginning, we could have run our business for like maybe $30 a month. There's zero risk. And we just went in with the attitude like, hey, let's just give this a try. If it works, great. If not, you can always go back to work in case things get really bad. And I'm going to keep my job. And what ended up happening is the business started taking off. And then I launched My Wife Quit Her Job, which is basically a journal of our business. I launched that in 2009. That started making money, I think, around 2011. And then I started thinking to myself, hey, you know, I really like my job. That was the difference. Like, I was an engineer. It's pretty much what I wanted to be all my life. And I had my dream job designing microprocessors alongside of a whole bunch of really smart people. So I actually didn't want to leave my job. But at some point, we were making so much money with the businesses that it didn't really make sense for me to be there 5 days a week. Like, I wanted to be there with the kids too. Mm-hmm. So I dropped down to 4 days. I dropped down to 3 days. I dropped down to 2 days. And then finally, I was just there once a week. And I had the...
Sounds like the dream.
Yeah.
Well, it was, because I still got to hang out. But the only reason I had that luxury was because I was one of three people that designed the main product that was making the bulk of the money for the company. So I was essentially there as an insurance policy. Problem is my big boss eventually left. A new boss came in, brought me into their office and was like, hey, what exactly do you do here 1 day a week?
You had an Office Space moment where they where they bring
it's
you
like, in. I boost the morale of everyone around me. Come on. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to be straight up with you. I don't do anything. But, you know, I'm here in case anything breaks or to attend meetings and advise. And then, you know. He was like, hey, either work here for at least 3 or 4 days or you're out. And so I left.
And sometimes it gets to that kind of ultimatum point in the process. And that's the goal, right, is for the ramp up, for the line to keep going up and to the right when it comes to the revenue that your business is generating so that you can eventually, like, take off and go do that full time. We want to talk to you more, Steve, about specifically, like, which business ideas to bet on and how to get started. So we've got some more questions for you on that front. We'll get to those right after this.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's say you've been listening to the podcast and now you're finally ready to start implementing some of the financial morsels that we're dishing up. Maybe you are trying to save up some more money for a down payment on a house, or maybe there's a big vacation that you have been dying to take. Well, the money app Monarch. They make it so easy to help you to reach your financial goals. That's why the Wall Street Journal, they named it the best app for growing your savings.
Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, collaborate with your partner even. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. And you won't get spammed either. Monarch features ad-free privacy you can trust. They will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads.
That's right, man. And after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. It just makes sense. It works. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. That's monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. For your extended 30-day free trial, go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney for an extended 30-day free trial. All right, we are back from the break talking with Steve Chu. And Steve, we're going to get a little more, you know, we kind of talked through your story, kind of how it is you view entrepreneurship at a high level, but we're going to get maybe a little more practical. And hopefully we can leave a lot of listeners out there with some ideas, maybe with some takeaways. And I think a lot of folks might be wondering how outside of the box that they could potentially get with a business idea, right? Because it feels like the sky might be the limit when it comes to just some of the different brainstorming that they might do. But how do you know if there's someone out there and they're listening and they're like, man, this is a good idea, or this is a weird, crazy idea? Like, is there a way that you help folks to distinguish whether an idea is just crazy or if it's just crazy good?
I mean, are we talking about physical products here or content?
Dealer's choice.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, let's just start with physical products, because that's something easy to understand, right? You sell something, you get money for it. All right. So these days, you can pretty much tell what anything sells for and how much they're making. There are tools such as Jungle Scout that will literally tell you how much every single listing on Amazon is making. Right, so there's really very few mysteries now in terms of how much you could potentially make given a product. Just look it up on Amazon, use Jungle Scout, it'll tell you. Now, the other thing is, I got students in my class that sometimes they tell me they're gonna launch something, and I'm like, dude, that's really saturated. It's gonna be a very hard road. But then they succeed. And the thing to realize here is that if you're good at selling something, you can pretty much sell anything. And you got to realize this. When you're selling anything online, chances are it's already a commodity. Like, there's very few inventions being sold. Like, heck, we sell handkerchiefs. Mm-hmm. We sell towels. We sell linens, right? No one's really invented that anything in that industry for a very long time. So what you got to realize is if you're trying to sell something, it's really about the emotions that you can evoke in a customer to get them to buy. Do you guys, have you ever heard of Dr. Squatch?
No.
Is that a soap?
Yes. Okay, they sell men's soap. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't care about soap. Like, I just use whatever's in the bathroom. So it's really hard to sell soap to a guy's market. But if you watch their commercials, you'll notice that there's always a female in the picture, and she's always like smelling the guy going, oh my God, you smell so good. I want to jump you right now. So they're not really selling the soap. Essentially, they're selling sex. And that's why they became this $100 million company. Mm-hmm. It's about the emotions that you evoke. And there's a whole bunch of emotions that you can evoke to get someone to buy something. And sex just happens to be one of them.
Hmm. Yeah, talk about the other emotions, because there are other ways which you can make a product stand apart, not necessarily, and that's what Coke's doing, right? Coca-Cola, it's the response from the sip of Coke in the commercial, and you're like, yeah, that does look refreshing, but clearly it's not like quenching your thirst. That's not what Coke's there to do, but they're selling kind of a lifestyle, a way of being, and that's what a lot of the most successful brands do, right?
Mm. Technically, yeah, this is called the Life Force 8, which, by the way, sounds like some indie band, but yeah, it's some of these different ways that you're able to appeal to folks.
Yeah, anything that shows that you're enjoying life, or you're keeping up with the Joneses, like you're high class, or anything that helps you protect your loved ones. I mean, there's a number of different emotions that you can evoke. And if you can do that, you can make someone buy anything.
Makes me think, like my daughter recently used her own money to buy a really expensive water bottle, a Stanley water bottle. And I didn't realize these were a thing.
Insulated water cup.
And now I look around and I see like all the ladies around here drinking out of Stanley water bottles. They're $45 a piece. And it's like, man, you can get a water bottle for $1.50. But for some reason, these evoke something. And they've somehow in their marketing, they've gotten enough people in on the expensive water bottle game that it's kind of starting to trickle down into other places. It's almost like selling itself.
I mean, just look at the iPhone. I'm an Android guy. And so whenever I look at the iPhone, I'm like, this is just way overpriced for what you get. They're always behind in terms of technology, but they do these little things like when my friend on iPhone messages me, it's not green or whatever color, you know? And so I'm like this outcast.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You're a pariah, Steve.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And so these are just things that Apple does. Apple's like phenomenal at marketing. Mm-hmm. I remember when they released the iPad and then Google released their tablet. Google was touting features like processor speed and battery life and all this stuff. Apple comes out with this commercial where like these little kids create this video for grandpa.
Oh, and grandma, I totally remember that thing.
Yeah. Grandma had passed away and they put together this really good skit. And, you know, a lot of people started tearing up at the end of that video.
Well, it's like Publix commercials during the holidays. They make you cry. It's not about, hey, look, we got the best selection at the lowest prices. It's all about shopping as a pleasure. And it's just a different way of selling a product.
It's a way to market it, a way to stand out. Yeah. Steve, so as folks are kind of brainstorming and thinking through what it is, like you've got an individual and maybe they're not thinking products. They're just thinking about, like, I just want to do something for myself. Mm-hmm. You, in your book, you warn against chasing businesses that we think are going to make us happy. What role do you think passion should play when it comes to starting up a side business?
I mean, I'm a practical guy. And when I think of the word passion, I think of, like, you know, when you first start dating and, you know, you're really interested in this girl or whatnot. But, you know, that might fade after a while. But if you have some sort of special skill or knowledge or advantage, you should always take advantage of that first when it comes to business. Right. I mean, I have students in my class, they're having problems figuring out what to sell. And then, you know, in casual conversation, it'll come up, by the way, did I mention that my wife is a chiropractor? Like this guy wanted to sell back pillows. And I'm like, dude, that's really competitive and whatnot. And then he mentions his wife's a chiropractor and like she's known for this. I'm like, oh my God, yeah, totally sell that.
This right? is your unfair advantage that you have.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah. So like different businesses make sense for different folks based on kind of their life experience, their expertise, their passion. Like it's a combination of all of those different things, right? And you have to kind of, what would you say, put all those together to figure out maybe the best route forward for you?
I mean, passion fades. I think that's the problem. I mean, you look at us, we sell handkerchiefs. Definitely not my first choice. I'm not really into hankies, but over the years, I've actually come to know the industry really well, and I'm very passionate about the business. Because once you start making money, you'll get all excited over, you know, just the business aspects.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times you call these side bets, right? It's something that you are working on while you are maintaining your 9-to-5 in order to pay the bills, but you are exploring, you're following your curiosities. And essentially, you talk about how folks oftentimes will end up falling into whatever side business that they happen to start, and it ends up being successful. I guess I'm thinking of specifically, you mentioned a gamer, and he's just like, man, all I do is I work, I come home, I eat, I play video games for a few hours, and then I'm not good at anything.
Yeah.
And then you start asking him questions about his gaming specifically. Can you share that story?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I mean, I deal with a lot of people who are stuck deciding what they want to do. And sometimes it's just right under your nose. So yeah, just like you said, I asked him what he did during the day, what he was good at, and he's like, I'm not good at anything. Yeah. Like, that's impossible, man. That's impossible. And so when we got to this game that he played, like, because I game a little bit. And so I asked him what he was playing, and then he got all excited and animated. I'm like, okay, what you got to do is just document, like, your excitement for the game. And he ended up creating this YouTube channel, and the last time I checked, it had thousands of subscribers. And, you know, incidentally, that's like how Twitch got started, right? People wanting to follow gamers and watch them play. And so there's totally a market for this stuff.
All right. So we talk about, like, physical products a lot. What about, you mentioned creating other things, like you've started a blog as well. And people have made businesses specifically launched on social media, you know, sites like Instagram, TikTok, whatever. You can have a fully fledged business, literally most of it based all around social media. So what are your thoughts? Like, how do you help people think about whether or not they should be getting into the physical product game or getting into kind of the online content game?
Yeah. So when someone asks me that question, I always say, hey, you know, it really just depends on your time frame for making money. Like, if you want to make money sooner rather than later, it's always easier to sell a physical product because, you know, the product kind of stands on its own, right? So I would say if you want to make money within a year, physical products is probably good. If you don't have the budget for physical products, then content is great if you have a runway of, let's say, 2 or 3 years. Nothing I ever did in the content space made me money less than, I would say, 2 years, because it takes time to build an audience. Mm-hmm. But once you do build that audience, and you guys can probably attest to this for your podcast, the money just goes exponential after a while. So e-commerce ramps up pretty quickly, but it kind of goes up and to the right, but content is like flat, and then all of a sudden it hockey sticks up in terms of revenue.
So, like, back in your early blogging days, you were writing, not seeing much in return from, like, a monetary perspective. What was it like, and how did you turn on kind of the cash flow spigot from that website?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't think I made any money for 2 years or anything significant. And the way you got to view content is you got to grind through it. Like, I just put myself on a schedule where I just wrote one blog post a week. And after a while, you'll know when it's time, because when I started writing about my e-commerce store, everyone started asking me for a class, right? And I didn't want to do a class, but people just kept asking for it. And finally I said, okay, fine. I don't have any content right now, but if you guys pay me $300 and if I sign up, you know, 10 people, I'll launch this class. And then 35 people signed up and I was like, oh man, okay, I guess I got to start this class. And I've been running it now for over a decade, and it's been very lucrative for me. I'm very happy that I did it. So that was one way that I monetized. A different way was, you know, I use a whole bunch of products in my store, and almost all these products, they have an affiliate program. And I'm just recommending out the existing products that I use to run my online store. And so it's a win-win.
And one of the things you did there that you mentioned was the fact that you kind of asked your audience what they wanted, and they were telling you what they wanted, and then you had to deliver on that. And it's just like you were assessing the demand before you went through the trouble of creating the product. Is that kind of a recipe that others can follow, whether we're talking about physical products or whether we're talking about how to interact with your audience to kind of get that idea of how much demand there is in the marketplace before you go through the trouble of creating the thing?
I mean, you always want to validate. So we already talked about how I did it for my class. And in fact, I didn't even ask them what they wanted. They just kept telling me what they wanted. It was driving me nuts. on the physical product side, there's things that you can do. So we already mentioned Jungle Scout. You can see, you know, how much every listing on Amazon is making. But if you're still a little bit squeamish about launching your product, there are these services where you can literally just create a product photo of potentially what you want to sell, and then pit it up against existing Amazon listings, send out a poll of just random Amazon shoppers, and they'll tell you which one they would buy out of those different images and product descriptions. So you can get a pretty good idea of whether you're going to succeed before you even get started.
That's great, specifically from a product standpoint. But as you're thinking about services and maybe content, like some folks, they specifically start a business because they're able to just simply identify a problem and then they are able to provide a solution. But like what you're talking about here is niching down. And oftentimes you can focus on a specific customer base, figure out what it is that they need. Like, are those two approaches at odds with each other? Because on one hand, it seems like you're starting with the problem But then with the other approach, it sounds like you are starting with a customer base. So are those at odds, or are they essentially kind of different sides of the same coin?
I really just think it depends on which marketplace. So everything I mentioned on the physical product side was regarding Jungle Scout. That's just for like the Amazon marketplace, because you can't really, you know, there's no real content involved with Amazon, and pretty much the picture sells, right? If this is your own website, however, then yes, what you said is absolutely true. You need to find a group of people, a small group of people that'll be interested in your products, and then market that product to that particular individual. So I guess the strategy just changes depending on where you're selling and what you're trying to do.
Talk to me about pricing, because when you're creating an online course, for instance, you said, what, $300, I think, is what you were going to charge, and then 35 people signed up. How'd you come up with that number? And physical products, it might even be a little bit easier. You can see your competition. But even in that realm, right, no one thought that $150 leggings from Lululemon, people were going to buy those things because, hey, I can get something really similar, a knockoff on Amazon for $20. So how do you think through pricing of your product or your service?
Yeah. So when it comes to products, I always say just target the high end, because just running the business is so much easier. And these days, you pretty much have to have your own brand. Because of Amazon, like a whole bunch of these manufacturers are just throw up stuff on Amazon. Everything looks the same over there.
Yeah.
So you got to have your own brand. You got to have a strong value prop. And if you can target the high end, that just makes everything easier. Customer service, it makes advertising easier and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going for the cheapest absolute price, I mean, that's the race to the bottom. And you're virtually never going to win when it comes to scale against some of these larger companies.
Even if you do win, you lose by winning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you might make a little bit of money in the beginning, but eventually other competitors will hop on, and it's just a race to the bottom unless you have a brand and a value prop.
Yeah.
Right. And a brand isn't established overnight. I mean, the way you establish a brand is you bring people back to your content over and over and over again until you become kind of ingrained in their mind.
Yeah.
There's a lot of brands that I follow, yeah. and I'll just buy no matter what. So for example, Tide laundry detergent. I'll buy Tide even though there's like this detergent at the supermarket that's like one third the price.
Yeah,
it's just because you have an affinity for the brand, the story that they've told over time is you just have an allegiance to that brand.
Essentially, yeah. Because, yeah. I mean, why experiment when I already have something that I like?
Well, it's funny because I've developed something similar to like a men's clothing seller online. It's like, man, you get men's clothes anywhere, but there's this one place and they just curate so well. And so that's my one-stop shop now for when I'm getting something new in my closet. But their stuff is definitely, it's pricier. I'm looking for sales. But it's interesting how that can be the case. They're also, like, you could go buy these clothes at the individual product maker sites, but I always find myself going back to this one website because they're doing such a good job curating everything.
Yeah, and a lot of times the personality, and this might not be the case for you, but sometimes it's the personality of the curator that matters too.
Sure, yeah.
There are these guys I follow on YouTube for tennis because that's a sport I really like. And I basically follow all their recommendations.
A lot of times I think it's almost like a combination of both things, right? Like, I guess so far we've been talking about creating a product or creating content. But as I think about it, you're kind of talking about Tide, or Joel, you're talking about the men's site. Like, I can think of a couple brands where the reason that I think, and I kind of know that they're the best, is because of the fact that they are also creating content to kind of go alongside the product. And so that's just a part of their marketing story, but it truly is content. Like, I am learning things, and it just so happens that they have products that help me to solve the problems that they are presenting. But Steve, we have a couple more questions that we're going to get to here right after the break. We're going to, I guess, discuss some of the things that hold folks back as entrepreneurs. And we also want to know what keeps you going, even though you have found such amazing success. We'll get to all that and more right after this. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's say you've been listening to the podcast and now you're finally ready to start implementing some of the financial morsels that we're dishing up. Maybe you are trying to save up some more money for a down payment on a house, or maybe there's a big vacation that you have been dying to take. Well, the money app Monarch, they make it so easy to help you to reach your financial goals. That's why the Wall Street Journal, they named it the best app for growing your savings.
Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, collaborate with your partner even. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. And you won't get spammed either. Monarch features ad-free privacy you can trust. They will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads.
That's right, man. And after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. It just makes sense. It works. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. That's monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. For your extended 30-day free trial, go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney for an extended 30-day free trial.
All right, we're back. We're still talking with Steve Chu. We're talking about entrepreneurship, but doing it in a way that allows you to keep the family first, not going overboard and, you know, sinking your whole ship, turning off all those other burners so that you can, yeah, actually enjoy the reason you started the business in the first place. And Steve, you've given a lot of great tips already, but even when folks know the right things to do in order to launch a successful business, they can fail taking that first step. So how would you suggest people get over the fear of, oh, what if I'm not successful? Oh, what if I'm, you know, putting $500 into this thing and it falls flat on the face? Or I spend 6 months even maybe working towards this goal and it doesn't go anywhere.
I mean, for most cases, the failure is entirely an ego thing, right? Because it really is so cheap to launch something these days. I can't imagine it's about the money for most people, I should say. Mm-hmm. It's really about your ego, right? Like when we were starting the handkerchief business, we had a lot of people going, oh, you know, how's your business doing? Kind of like in a derogatory manner.
And yeah, they're basically making fun of you by asking how things are going.
Exactly. And I knew that if I failed, you know, this would hurt my ego. I mean, I guess the easiest thing to do is just to play the what's the worst that can happen game.
Oh, yeah.
So if our business failed, I mean, my wife would just go back to work, right? I would keep my job, and that's the worst thing that could happen. Let's say we both lost our jobs. Worst case scenario, I'd move back in with my parents. I mean, that'd be really bad, but, you know, it's not like I'm in danger of anything. And I think if most people play that game, they'll find that none of this stuff is really drastic. I think the hardest part for people not starting is really analysis paralysis. And whenever an engineer signs up for my course, I'm always like, oh man, okay, yeah. This is going to be tough. Because
they're going to be emailing you nonstop wanting to analyze everything, dissect every possible scenario. Yeah.
They want to know all the answers, whether it's guaranteed to be profitable and all that stuff. And that's kind of not the way it works, you know? You got to take a small leap of faith, a small risk, and it's just a matter of probabilities. And, you know, if something doesn't work, you try something else.
Yeah. One of the things you're getting at here, too, or I wanted to touch on was you tell folks that they need to go ahead and start before they actually feel ready, because there are always going to be different obstacles excuses, that crop up, excuses, other things that you can analyze. And it's real things. It's things that, yes, technically could happen, but the likelihood of those things happening, who knows? But I think a lot of folks might find themselves in that position where they're thinking, oh, I am interested in pursuing this. Oh, this is something I do want to hang my own shingle, but that fear, I think it does hold them back a little bit.
Here's a common one that I get all the time. They're like, hey, you know, what happens if someone knocks me off? Should I spend all this money on a lawyer to protect this? And I'm like, if you're getting knocked off, that's a good thing. That means you're selling a lot, that someone wants to knock you off, and by then you'll have enough money to take care of this.
No, that's good stuff. Okay, so how do we define success then? Part of you, the way you define success is by being able to not let the business take over your life. But it can also be difficult to know whether a business is successful or not. It's like, oh, well, it feels mediocre success, right? Like that's where I feel like I'm at right now. And so I'm just not sure, like, am I on the right track? Is this something that I need to keep leaning into or not?
All right, so I always ask myself a couple questions when that happens. First one, and probably the most important one, is am I still learning, right? If I'm still learning and picking up skills, I'll probably continue to do it. The other thing is, you know, do I hate doing it? If I have that attitude, then I'm probably going to quit. Everyone's going to have different parameters, you know, for certain things. Like if I feel like I'm actually doing good and I'm helping people, that might be enough for me to continue doing something.
All right. So we talked about this right before we started recording, and you live in a really high cost of living area. And even though you don't necessarily, and it's Silicon Valley, right? So it's one of those places where, yeah, that's where the high paying jobs are for people in your former industry. So it makes sense that you were there in the beginning. But when your wife says, I want to quit my job, and you're thinking, and especially once you get to the point where the new boss comes in and he says, Steve, we don't need you anymore if you're not more committed, and you peace out, you could totally save so much money by moving elsewhere. What is it that kept you in a really high cost of living area? Do you have to be there for your businesses that you operate solo now? Or is it just because family, friends, like what keeps you rooted there?
Yeah, I mean, the business can be run anywhere, right? That's not the problem. It's mainly family and friends. And then plus, you know, worst case scenario, this was back in the day when we first started our businesses, I could have just gone back to work as an engineer. I had a lot of contacts. My wife could have easily gotten a job also.
So it was a strategic move in that sense, right?
Staying close by. And then, you know, I've talked to a lot of friends about this over the years, and they're always like, hey, you should never move just because of the money, right? If you enjoy where you live, you like the weather. I mean, the weather here is fantastic. You guys are living through thunderstorms right now, right?
As opposed to the rumbles that you're hearing on our end, exactly.
And I'm a pretty cheap guy. I don't spend that much money. So I could save a lot of money, but I'm not even really spending my money right now. So why not just enjoy where I'm at?
Okay, I love that. What keeps you going then? Because at this point, you've talked about this, way more money than you could spend. You haven't really necessarily moved the goalposts where you're like, I just really want a Bugatti, or I want three different, you know, second homes that I can go to on my private jet. You don't seem to care about that stuff. So what is it that keeps you grinding with the businesses that you have, which are multiple, even though you're basically financially independent?
Yeah, you know, just the way my mind works, I always have to be working on something. Which is basically why I tell everyone I'm never going to retire, because that sounds boring to me, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever we go on vacation, my wife actually likes lying by the beach or lying by the pool. I can actually only do that for like 2 hours. And then I got to go do something. And so, you know, what's nice now is I have the opportunity to choose what I want to do. So, you know, 1 year I might want to just do YouTube because I like making videos, or I might want to explore the TikTok platform. I love podcasting. I wouldn't give that up for anything because I get to meet someone new every single week, right? So the freedom I have now basically allows me to pick and choose what interests me.
Yeah, that's obviously an awesome place to be in, right? Where essentially like all these different aspects of your business is kind of like it's like playing in a sandbox. And you're like, oh, I think I want to go over here now, kind of craft, work on this, learn something along the way, meet somebody interesting. And that's one of the massive benefits of being an entrepreneur, is the ability to kind of focus on some of the different areas, not only that you are skilled, but the different areas that interest you. Steve, okay, so I've got one last question, I guess, for you, because you talk about, so you shared a little bit with, I guess, your story early on with your folks being first gen, but essentially you didn't see a ton of them. But now I'm assuming your kids see a ton of you, right? Like you talk about how you don't miss any games at all, period, I think, that your kids might have. Joel, like we've talked with a friend of ours, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, because he was saying that he thinks it's really important for his kids to see him working, right? Like him, in his case, pursuing something he's really excited about. And obviously, I'm sure your kids know that you have businesses and this is something that you find fulfilling. But I guess, do you think it's possible for some folks out there to maybe overly focus on family, essentially, to the detriment of maybe your own personal development or in the case of your ability to really chase after something and find fulfillment that way?
Yeah, I've questioned whether like all the time we spend together is like, you know, is harming them. But on the flip side, I still have like my parents' Asian blood in me. And so like they started businesses, you know, my daughter's working on a course right now on how to sell on Etsy. And so we're filming and all that stuff. So they're working.
Oh, that's awesome.
They see me work and then they're doing their own thing.
Well, it sounds like they're following in your footsteps too. And they're doing it in a way in which you get to work alongside them, which sounds really cool. Not just, you know, playing board games together, which is fun. I love that part of it. But also like, hey, let's go down this path and let's see if the things that I enjoy, if you enjoy those things too. So, well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Where can our listeners, where can people in How to Money Land find out more about you and what you're up to and obviously about your book too?
Yeah, if you guys are interested in learning about e-commerce, the easiest way is just sign up for my free mini course over at mywifequitherjob.com. If you guys are interested in checking out the book, that can be found over at thefamilyfirstentrepreneur.com. I'm actually still giving out over $690 in free bonuses. You'll get a free workshop on how to get started in e-commerce and a free 2-day workshop on how to get started making money with content. I also run an annual e-commerce conference called the Seller Summit, if you guys ever want to hang out in person. I also run a top 25 podcast called My Wife Quit Her Job. You should be able to find it on iTunes or wherever you listen to a podcast. And I'm also on YouTube, and the channel is called My Wife Quit Her Job as well.
So many irons in the fire, Steve. I love it.
We will make sure to link to all of that, Steve. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, man, that was super fun talking with Steve, who, you heard it at the end.
It's like, what's up?
He also does a lot of things. He has done a lot of things, which just shows how interested he is in a whole lot of different sorts of pursuits, but he's also done well in a bunch of those pursuits. So, yeah.
It's like, I'm not a serial entrepreneur.
Right. Exactly, Steve.
He owned up to it.
We totally believe you. But yeah, and I love that he also says, you know what? This is fun to build these businesses, but it's not the end all be all. So I don't know. What was your big takeaway from this combo?
I like when he touched on ego. And I think for a lot of folks out there, I think there are a lot of folks in the position where they're thinking, I really want to kind of go do my own thing. But there, you know, there's that fear that's holding them back.
And what if I screw it up?
What if I screw it up? And I do think that oftentimes, I think when you have gotten pretty good at your job, maybe you're middle management, or maybe you're even higher up on the food chain, you don't want to be perceived as a failure. And honestly, the more successful you get at your 9-to-5, I think the harder it is to be able to step back from that and to pursue something else that, yes, might actually fail.
Like you're only used to success. And so now failure feels even worse.
Exactly. As opposed to, like, I guess for me, I think back to when Kate and I started our photography company, and we had very little success up until that point. And now I realize, I guess we kind of knew that at the time. Like, that's one of the things I remember that we telling each other. We said that, what have we got to lose? Like, this is the time to do it. We were renting. We didn't have any debt. We didn't have any kids. We didn't even have any pets. Very few possessions. And so there was very little that was actually holding us back. But I guess hearing him talk about it helped me to realize how much of a blessing that is. But I like that he mentioned ego as well, because that he mentions that in his book, and we didn't touch on it, but I wanted to share it real quick, and how when it comes to an individual's desire to grow a business, to scale it, that oftentimes folks call that impact, but how truly what that is ego disguised. Mm. It's the desire for you as an individual to kind of like prove yourself that, like, oh, I've got what it takes. Oh, we're a business that rakes in $1 million plus every year. Mm-hmm. And then eventually maybe it turns into 10 million because now you've got to essentially raise the bar, and how at the core of that oftentimes is ego. And, you know,
a lot of people on social media tooting that horn. Now I've got a 7-figure
exactly.
business, and it sounds so sexy, and you're like, oh, I'm not as cool as they are.
Yeah.
But behind that facade, I guess, it might not be exactly as they're making it appear.
Sure.
And that, I mean, that's, isn't that the problem with social media in general?
Oh, yeah, of course. And I think for us, it's kind of like getting to the point to where you just don't care anymore, yeah. right? Like, and oftentimes, and this is why it's Family First Entrepreneurs, like that's Steve's book. But I think a lot of times parents are able to identify that because you get to a point to where a lot of that ego doesn't matter. You're just trying to successfully create more, like raise this human being to be a fully functioning adult, like Lacey Langford said in a previous episode. And it's difficult to essentially to kill that ego and to tell yourself that it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
But what was your big takeaway?
I think mine was when he said that more money can create this like fever. And that's where he was when his wife came to him with that conversation saying like, hey, so we're doing great revenue-wise. Like, we're making money. We've actually surpassed the goals that we had of making $60K a year and then surpassing my income so that I could stay at home. So why are we like...
But I hate this.
Yeah.
Like, literally, she was just like crying because she did not want to do it anymore.
And we live pretty frugally. So why in the world are we going this hard, Steve? And that was the light bulb moment for him, that like family first entrepreneurship was the way forward. And I think it's true that as our income grows, as we're able to do more things with our money, more smart things even, right? It can create sort of like a fever in us where it starts to feel like money is the goal rather than the tool. And so that's something we talk about a whole lot on the show, because we want money. More money is a goal in some ways, right? But in other ways, money is just a tool to allow you to do so much of what you actually want to be doing with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always smart to go back to the drawing board, especially as, let's say, you have a much better year this year financially than you had in the prior 2 years or something like that. Well, don't let that feed this desire to continue to grow and grow and scale if that's not necessarily, you know, the underlying desire that you have. If family first entrepreneurship is actually what you want, or living a balanced life, right, where you work 30, 35 hours a week and you actually make a little bit less money on purpose, if that's what you want, because that creates the lifestyle you're looking for, it kind of goes back to the four burners theory as well, too. Like, you can turn all those other ones off and be a really unhappy, highly successful entrepreneur, but that's not what most people are after.
That's right, man. Let's get to our beer that you and I enjoyed during this episode. This was an Ubu Ale. Let's see. This was brewed right here in Lake Placid. So I say that because that's what's written on the note that Rebecca and Dylan sent our way.
We're not broadcasting from Lake
Placid. No. Yeah. This is their thank you note. So we had them on the show. They are the Rad Coaches. Where we talked about couples and money, and they were kind enough to send us a beer. So Ubu Ale. This is by Lake Placid Craft Brewing Company. It doesn't say what style this beer is, Joel, but
I looked it up because I wanted to know.
Did you dig it? It's kind of like a porter.
It's like it's got porter vibes. It's actually an English strong is how they classify it. But this one's like roasty notes, toffee vibes going on, some fig notes going on in there too. Almost like a little bit of a barley wine quality, almost like a barley wine mixed with a porter. So this one's interesting. Good flavor, and this is definitely more of like a fall beer, getting into fall time.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I enjoyed this one. Big thanks to Rebecca and Dylan for sending it our way.
Yes, thank you to the Rad Coaches. But Joel, that's going to be it for this episode. We'll make sure to link to some of the different resources that Steve mentioned. He's got a lot of freebies up there as well. And so, yeah, we'll link to all that. You can find those up on the show notes at howtomoney.com. But, buddy, that's going to be it. So until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4,
Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.